I'd like to speak from three separate psalms. And the first one is Psalm 137. All three psalms have to do with the same era in Israel's history. You may recall that the Old Testament nation of Israel became very rebellious against God, and finally God punished them by destroying the nation and taking off the people into captivity, or rather other nations came and took the people off into captivity into different places. And most of them finished up in Babylon. Now there in Babylon, they were not kept as convicts chained to iron balls or locked up in cells. They lived in labor camps scattered around the place, and they worked for the government for nothing. And they had Babylonian slave masters over them, and so that was the condition under which the people lived there. One of these camps was on a riverside somewhere in Babylon, and among them was an Israelite songwriter who wrote this short psalm, Psalm 137. It's a very sad psalm because the people were there suffering greatly through the mocking and the jeering and the tormenting of their Babylonian masters. The Babylonians were getting a good laugh at the expense of the poor Jews. There were those Jews thinking of glorious Jerusalem, the place where God dwelt, the motherland, the home of the free, and all that sort of thing. And now here they were, in Babylon, as slaves of a foreign government, and their homeland was hundreds of miles away, and Jerusalem, the glorious city, was a heap of rubble and ashes. The temple that they thought nobody would ever destroy, because that was God's dwelling place and God would never let anybody destroy his temple, the temple was now in ruins. And the Jews haven't got anything to sing about. They think of Jerusalem, and the more they think of it, the sadder they get. And so in verse 1, by the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Zion, of course, was the main hill in Jerusalem. No musical instruments, guitars, mandolins, lyres, banjos, organs, whatever they had. They had no heart for playing music, no heart for singing songs, and so they hung up their musical instruments on the trees. On the willows there we hung up our lyres, because our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, come on, sing us some of the songs of Zion. Really rubbing it in. How about singing that song, Jerusalem, the everlasting dwelling place of God? Sing that one to us. That would be a good one. Come on, sing it. That's a good boy there. Come along and sing some nice Jewish songs for us. And so the Babylonians tormented these people. You could imagine the Americans conquered by Libya and the people taken captive into Libya, and there's Colonel Gaddafi saying to them, come on, sing some of those great songs of America. God bless America. Or America the Beautiful, with Washington lying a heap of ashes and New York destroyed and all these people over there in Libya. And Colonel Gaddafi burning the American flag in front of their eyes and saying, come on, why not sing that magnificent song of yours, the Stars and Stripes Forever? Well, this is what's happening to these Jews, you see. The Babylonians are tormenting them, and they say, we can't, in verse 4, we can't sing the Lord's song in a foreign land. We can't sing here as captives in this place and think of the wonders of Jerusalem. In fact, if I did that to Jerusalem in verse 5, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, if I would trample your holy name in the dust like that and make songs about you to the glee and the mirth of our tormentors, if I did that, then let my right hand wither. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, O Jerusalem, if I do not set you above my highest joy. Nothing is going to make us stoop to that level. Go to Psalm 79. Of the second of our psalms. We don't know who wrote Psalm 137, but the man who wrote these next two was a man called Asaph. And there's a little bit of bitterness in Asaph too. There's a mixture here of disappointment, sadness, almost bitterness that all these evils have befallen them. And when they feel the taunts and the jeers of their captors, it really is a bit much. And so they remind God of what has happened, as if to plead with God to come to their aid and to take note of what all these filthy heathens are saying about him. Verse 1, 79. O God, the heathen have come into thy inheritance, and they've defiled thy holy temple, the place where you dwell, your temple, your holy temple. These filthy heathens, these Babylonian soldiers have come into that temple, and they've marched through it. We didn't think any Gentile would ever get through the doors of that temple. In fact, even if anybody other than a priest entered the holy place, he would be struck dead. And they thought that because of that, God was going to allow their temple to stand forever, and that somehow that committed him to defending Jerusalem. And God had to teach the Jews a lesson that they had broken his laws and they no longer were fit to dwell in his land. And now, something they never thought could happen has happened. And so these people are again in Babylon, and they're casting their minds back to what happened in Jerusalem, and they're saying to God, won't you stir yourself now and act on our behalf to restore our fortunes and to bring us back to the land. Oh God, look what the heathen have done. They've laid Jerusalem in ruins. They've smashed the buildings. They've burnt the temple. Verse 2, they've given the bodies of thy servants to the birds of the air for food, and the flesh of thy saints to the beasts of the earth. Slaughtered the people, those that they didn't take into captivity, they slaughtered them and left their bodies lying all over the ground. And they poured out their blood like water round about Jerusalem. No one to bury them, corpses everywhere. And so in verse 4, we have become a taunt to our neighbours, mocked and derided by those round about us. How long, O Lord? How long is this going to go on? Will you be angry forever, he asks, angry with us? Are you going to allow us to sit here in Babylon and waste away? Please, verse 6, pour out your anger against the nations who do not know thee. Don't pour it out against us, who are your people. We've had enough now. We've been punished. Okay, now give them their deserts. Because in verse 7, they have devoured Jacob and they've laid waste his habitation. They now deserve your judgment. Give them a taste of what we've had. He sobers up a little bit then in verses 8 to 10. And he reminds himself that they have broken God's laws and brought this disaster upon themselves. And so he prays for God's forgiveness and for their restoration to their land. He asks in verse 8 that God will not remember these sins against them. And in verse 9 he says, help us, O God of our salvation. Deliver us and forgive our sins. Getting near the real truth. Now they need forgiveness. That's what they need. But in verse 10 he reminds God of the way these nations are behaving. And they're saying, where is their God? This God of Israel that's supposed to be the eternal God, that's supposed to be the all-powerful God that brought them up out of Egypt, that did all these miracles. Where is he? He couldn't even defend his own house. His own house in Jerusalem, the temple. He couldn't even defend that. It's smashed and burnt and lies in ruins. He couldn't even save his people. Our gods are stronger than Israel's gods. That's what the Babylonians said. Where is their God? It's a myth. He's just something in their imagination. And so they taunt the Israelites. And the Israelites come to God and they say, why do you allow this to go on? Why should you allow the nations to say, where is their God? Let the avenging of the outpoured blood of thy servants be known among the nations before our eyes. Give them their punishment for the way they've slaughtered our people. And so they groan to God. They pour out their moans and their anguish before God. Verse 11, let the groans of the prisoners come before thee, and according to thy great power, preserve those doomed to die. Here are we doomed to die. O God, preserve us, cries out Asaph. And let the groans of these prisoners come before your ears. Back to Psalm 74, which is another psalm of Asaph. Actually, it's a maskil of Asaph. There were various types of songs, just as we have different types of songs. Some of them are psalms, or they are hymns, or they are anthems, or ballads, or folk songs. Likewise, in Israel, they had psalms, they had miktams, they had maskils, they had shigayons, and all sorts of other types of songs. I don't know the difference between all these different types of songs, but no doubt the original musicians did. Well, this one is a maskil of Asaph. And again he cries out, God, have you forgotten us? Again, the people are in Babylon, and they're reflecting upon the great disaster that has befallen Jerusalem. Oh, God, why dost thou cast us off? Have you cast us off forever? Are we to sit here forever? When are you going to change and bring us back into our land? Why does thy anger smoke against the sheep of thy pasture? Remember thy congregation. We're your people, he says. The ones that you redeemed to be the tribe of your heritage. Remember Mount Zion, where thou hast dwelt. But you're not dwelling there anymore, he says, because the temple is in ruins. And so think back to that, to Mount Zion in Jerusalem. And, oh God, he says, save us. In case God has forgotten what a mess Jerusalem is in, Asaph invites him in verse 3 to go and have a look at the ruins. Just remind himself of what filthy things these Babylonians did. Direct thy steps to the perpetual ruins. Go and have a look at the mess Jerusalem's in. The enemy has destroyed everything in the sanctuary, right into the very holy place of God in that temple. They went in there. They took all the treasures. They took all the gold. They stripped the walls. They stripped all the decoration from the temple. All the pots and pans and vessels of gold and silver and all the expensive equipment of the temple, they stripped the lot and they took it with them. And then what they didn't want, they smashed and burnt. And the enemy has destroyed everything in the sanctuary. And then he describes the scene of destruction. Verse 4. Thy foes have roared in the midst of the holy place. You can just imagine these soldiers rampaging through the temple, shouting and singing probably bawdy soldier songs in the holy place, in the temple of God. And they set up their own signs for signs. Maybe the standard or the flag of their regiment. Heathen Babylonian gods embroidered upon them. And they've set these heathen idols, these pagan images up in the temple of God. Verse 5, at the upper entrance, they hacked the wooden trellis with axes. And all its carved wood they broke down with hatchets and hammers, smashing, butchering. Anything they could see, they hacked away at all this beautiful material, all the lovely decoration that Solomon had so carefully planned and had carried out over years and years and years. And now these characters have gone in there and just left it in ruins. Verse 7, they set thy sanctuary on fire, and to the ground they desecrated the dwelling place of thy name. And they said to themselves, we'll utterly subdue them, we'll fix these Jews. And so they burned all the meeting places in the land. And so there's no one left now, and the place is deserted. Verse 9, we do not see our signs, there's no longer any prophet, and there is none among us who knows how long. It's all gone, all the messengers of God disappeared, and our land is in ruins, and the nation has come to an end. How long, O God, verse 10, how long is the foe to scoff? How long are you going to let this sort of thing to go on? Is the enemy to revile thy name forever? Once again, you see, reviling the name of God and saying, your God is a tin pot God, he couldn't stop anybody. He has no power, it's all in the mind. And so they revile God, and Asaph cries out to God, oh God, why won't you stop these people speaking the way they are? Why do you stand there and do nothing? Verse 11, why do you hold back your hand? Why do you keep your right hand in your bosom? Ancient clothing, of course. Today we'd say, why do you stand with your hands in your pockets? Why don't you do something? He's a little angry with God. Not always the right thing to do to get angry like this. Yet it's amazing how patient God is. Job, remember some of the things Job said to God. Asaph, he's getting a little strong in his language at times. Jeremiah, he said a few strong things too. We find that God didn't come down in immediate, heavy-handed judgment upon them, because he knew that deep within their souls they were seeking the truth. They weren't coming to God like angry young men who have no reverence for God. These were men who knew God, and yet something had gone wrong in their understanding of God. They thought that God would have done this, and then he didn't. And they can't understand why he allows these things to happen. This is the age-old problem. Why does not God intervene? Well, thankfully, God doesn't always intervene. Immediately something goes wrong, because if he did that, I think many of us would be very sorry indeed. For example, we do wrong things, and thankfully God doesn't intervene and bring down a heavy-handed judgment on us every time, but he is patient and long-suffering. He doesn't desire that we have these great calamities befall us. We, I'm afraid, think like Asaph. We think that God should come down with heavy-handed judgment upon other people when they do wrong, but we don't think he should do it against us when we do wrong. And yet God understands that anguish, that confusion and conflict and even bitterness and frustration that comes into the souls of his people at times. I think he understands Asaph. He can understand how a person would get a little bit prickly around the collar when one is frustrated and just can't see God's hand working. He's not doing what they thought he was going to do. But one of the things God has to teach us all is patience. He hasn't forgotten. He's not just standing around with his hands in his pockets doing nothing. He has a plan. He knows what he's doing. And in the course of doing that, he not only has to teach us lessons of patience, but also he has to show us our own weaknesses. And I think that is the path along which Jeremiah and Job and Asaph had been led. And I trust we also, in those moments of despair and frustration when we're tempted to throw our hands up and say, "Where is God? Why doesn't he do something?" We too must take note of the things that are said here in this psalm and realize that God has not forgotten. He does understand. And he will work in his time and in his way. Now Asaph starts to realize this because in the following few verses, 12 through to 17, he reminds himself that it's not that God doesn't have the power. God has the power. He's not in any doubt over that. What he's worried about is why God doesn't use his power. For example, he says in verse 12, God is from of old. He's worked salvation in the midst of the earth. He goes through some of the things that happened when God brought Israel out of Egypt. He divided the Red Sea. He took them through the wilderness. He gave them water out of dry country. He did all sorts of marvelous things for them. He has no doubt about God's power. What he's bothered about is why God doesn't use his power. But then God is not just there as somebody that we can use for our own convenience. God is sovereign. God's power is assured. And sometimes God does not act immediately. And he's got to teach us some of the lessons that I believe Asaph is now slowly learning. He goes on to talk about God's power in verse 13. You divided the sea. Verse 14, you crushed the heads of the great sea monster. In other words, you overthrew your enemies in the sea. Moving on, verse 15, you opened up springs in the desert. Verse 16, by day and by night, you are in control. Verse 17, you control everything in the earth. You have fixed the bounds of all things. You make summer and winter, everything's under your control. Nothing is outside God's control. Well, if that's the case, says Asaph in verse 18, why don't you remember how the enemy scoffs? These impious people, they revile thy name. Do not deliver the soul of thy dove to the wild beasts, Do not forget the life of thy poor forever. Here are we, he says, sitting here in Babylon, suffering like this. Oh, please, God, don't forget us. Don't let us be devoured by these wild Babylonians. Don't let us be wiped out. You see, he's asking now. He's starting to plead a little. Instead of demanding from God, he's now requesting of God, and that's a different thing. He urges God in verse 20 to have regard for his covenant, because the dark places of the land are full of the habitations of violence. Oh God, he says, let not the downtrodden be put to shame. Let the poor and the needy praise thy name. Don't let us be squashed by these filthy people. Arise, O God, verse 21, plead thy cause. Remember how the impious scoff at thee all the day. He's not only concerned about himself, but he is concerned about God. He doesn't like God's name being trampled in the dust by these heathen Babylonians. And he reminds God in verse 23 once again of the clamor of these enemies, of the way they roared in the temple and all the wicked things they did. And he hopes that this might spur God on to act on his behalf. So he's wrestling through the problem, you see. And at least he's speaking to God about it. And that's the great thing. He hasn't gone murmuring to other people and turning other people sour, but he's been speaking to God. And if we've got these problems and these hang-ups, speak to God about them. That's the message of the book of Job. The other three, the three friends of Job's, they argued about what God could do and what God was going to do and why God did this, and they talked about God, but Job was the one who talked with God, and that is the difference. And Asaph is talking with God, and Jeremiah was talking with God, and Job was talking with God, and we should talk with God. If we have these hang-ups, if we have these difficulties, bring it to God. And as we wrestle it through, we'll find that God is very understanding. More understanding than our brethren are. He doesn't chop us down the socks as soon as we've raised a query. There are queries, there are intellectual problems we have as to why this happens and why that happens. And as we trace the problem through and try to come to some sort of understanding, so often we get to the point that Asaph has got to, that we can't really see the answer. And if we can't see the answer, well, too bad. But at least we can see God. And we can realize that God has never promised to give us an answer to every problem that we face. But he does have the power. He does have the wisdom, and we can be assured that no matter what, God will do what is right and what is best in the long run. That's why I think that the heart of this psalm is in verse 20, where he says to God, have regard for thy covenant. The covenant, the agreement that he made with Israel when he chose them as his people, and he said, you are my people. I take you into a covenant relationship with myself. And when Asaph is at his wit's end, he can't make any demands upon God. He knows that Israel sinned. He's not trying to excuse them for their sin. All he can do is go back to that covenant, and he can cast himself upon the mercy and grace of God, and he can say, you chose us, Lord. What more can I say? Remember that covenant. And he claims the promises of God and in faith casts himself upon God's mercy. An interesting collection of psalms. People who are frustrated, people who are in difficulties, who can't see their way through the mist. They're a little angry at times, a bit frustrated. And yet their words have been preserved for us because I believe within them we can find a lesson for ourselves. That we talk to God. And as we trace these matters through, so we are led to the understanding that God is the one who has acted, God is the one who has done these things, and our hope is in his covenant, in his promises. And when all is said and done, we can simply cast ourselves upon his mercy, and like that man in the temple say, God, be merciful to me, a sinner.